Space communication. These will be among the main topics for dialogue.
Team Shanghai Watch, welcome back. It's been a while. I think it's been 2.5 years, Gary, since we last sat down.
Yeah.
And a lot's changed, that's for sure. A lot of positive change. And you brought the team along here with you today. Do you guys want to introduce yourself and let us know what you guys are up to at Shanghai Watch?
Sure. Yeah, thank you for having us, Dan. It's true that when you had Gary last time, we were just starting off. But since Sam and I have been joining the team full-time, I think it's been a growing project. So I'm Kelly. I'm half based in Paris and Bali, and I take care of all of the more data aspect of the work, so more brand auditing, better understanding the type of waste that we consume, all the finances and partnerships in Europe, to enable us to scale our work throughout Indonesia and hopefully the rest of the world.
Awesome. Sam, how about you?
Good to see you, Dan.
Good to see you too.
I'm Sam. I'm the youngest of the three. And I think within Shanghai Watch, I split my time mainly based here in Bali, but sometimes travel back to New York. And so when I'm in Bali, help Gary with the operations, but more based on partnerships, fundraising, and helping grow the foundation.
Cool. Well, thank you for coming down. It's great to see you all again. So this is very much a family-run thing then. Like, how did you guys grow up? I know a bit about your background from when you were younger, but how did you guys get into this in the beginning? Like, did your parents, are your parents environmentalists, or like, did you get introduced to this by somebody else? Like, how did you guys as a family all get behind these positive causes that you're rooting for?
Yeah, I think our parents were not at all a part of the reason. They are definitely, you know, big supporters, and they definitely always supported us and helped us and pushed us, you know, to continue doing this work, but never stemmed from them. It was just by growing up in Bali and seeing, you know, this beautiful island get more and more polluted as we're, you know, walking down the beaches, spending more time in the outdoors, seeing the accumulation of plastic get worse and worse every year. So we've been at it for, you know, 14 years from a really young age, sort of more as activists, raising awareness through education, through videos, by going on expeditions around the world that, you know, would, you know, hopefully influence, inspire people, and then more recently, more on the ground action with Shanghai Watch.
Awesome.
But there's not one thing that we're still trying to figure out how and why we're all together and working towards it. So it's a question that we get asked a lot. And we're still trying to see if there's like one moment, one particular event. I think it's just over the time and seeing our paradise island just getting dirtier and dirtier over time.
I think when you're 14 years old and you're trying to, you know, create a team, you tend to rely on your best friends, your closest circle. And so, you know, like I remember when we first initially started, you know, the first people that we called upon was, you know, we were brainstorming in our living room with close friends. You know, the first ever thing that we did was climbing Gunung Agung with some of our best friends to raise money for our first cleanup operations, to buy boots, gloves, and bags. And, you know, this was done, I think, in Sam's bedroom. And it started from there and it continued. And then we started, you know, thinking more crazy and crazy and crazy. And now I think we've kept together. Because we're brothers and sisters, we don't fight so much. We have the same vision. And, you know, if we do have a fight, we'll resolve it
within 5 minutes.
A couple of minutes to think about more of the long-term vision.
That's awesome. Yeah, I think I moved to Bali. Well, I did move to Bali in 2014, and I saw some of the videos we're doing, and you were kind of like young activists. And then when we met during the pandemic, you specifically spoke about the new project you were going to work on, and it was Shanghai Watch, and you were telling me about the rivers. And I remember specifically you saying that you really wanted to narrow your focus, and you sort of landed on rivers being the one thing that you felt could make the biggest impact. How did you land on rivers, and what was the thing that made you decide, okay, I need to just narrow down my focus or kind of energy around this one thing in order to make impact? Because 2.5 years later, you've made monumental impact, which we'll get on. But how did you get to that point where you thought, let's just focus on rivers now?
So, you know, very quickly in our cleanup efforts, we realized that about 80 to 90% of plastic pollution comes from rivers and streams in the ocean. And I think rivers are the perfect connection point between life on land and the ocean. you know, we can engage so much better with communities. People see our work. You know, if we're king of the ocean, who's going to see? Nobody. So I think that there's really an aspect of community that is super well integrated in this river work. But ultimately, you know, that's where we stop the leak. And so much of our work has been very bandage solution oriented, you know, placing barriers, floating barriers to stop the flow. But ultimately, you know, really working upstream with religious leaders, with, you know, all different sources of communities around the island, from women groups to youth groups to the farmer groups and farming communities. And so, yeah, the rivers have been, I think, the most direct way of changing our mindset, our relationship to plastic, and really bringing people, you know, on this environmental journey. You know, I think when you start looking at plastic pollution, it's so hard to think about how individually we all are contributing, although we all use it on a day-to-day basis. But when you get in a river with, you know, water flowing up to your waist, you see, you know, more than just plastic floating at the surface. It stinks, you know, rotten eggs, you have dead animals. Then you start to really realize our impact on our planet. And so, yeah, rivers have been really the ways that we're doing our work, and we're really trying to, you know, clean one river at a time, starting, you know, with our first river, which was the river in the back of our parents. But our second river was the river in the back here, just next to where we are right now.
Yeah, literally on the street here. Yeah, that's the first one. Amazing. And that yeah, that aspect of the community, because you do see it, right? You guys are like physically there, and everybody's driving past, and you see hundreds of people cleaning. I guess that, do you think that's been one of the aspects that's made it a success in terms of getting people on board, that people can feel, okay, these guys are making a real difference on my street, and I really want to kind of help? Do you think that's, is that how a lot of people have got attracted to it? Or do you think, like, how, what's been that thing, that sort of community aspect of what you guys have built? How do you think that's happened? Is that through the street side of thing, or is it other things that you've been doing, content or?
Yeah, I think it's because the barriers that we install are super simple and super visual. So we always make sure they're placed by a barrier, by like a river path, so that the idea is that it's, as you say, people just see it. And it's a really good reminder that there's nothing is out of sight, out of mind when it comes to trash. People kind of like throw their trash even if they think it's recycled, and they'll never think about it again. But here, because they know that we are cleaning those barriers on a daily basis, when you see the barrier stopping a certain amount of waste, it on a daily frequency, I think it contributes to shifting your mind and kind of realizing and wanting to help, wanting to understand better, wanting to question what you're consuming on a daily basis. So that's how we've received the most, I think, contributions and like volunteers helping and wanting to like just want to be more involved and learning how to help.
Yeah, I think adding to that, we've always been very, very active on social media, and growing our online community has been an amazing way for us to get people to come to cleanups,
you know, and learning how to help.
A lot of before and after photos, time lapses, and people that drive past the polluted river every single day thinking to themselves, you know, on their motorbike, on their car, that this river is so dirty. And, you know, they keep driving, but they don't do anything. And then all of a sudden, when they see that river being clean, and they see the before and after, and they see the time lapse, I think it like motivates people and inspires people to come and join the next cleanup. So it's really cool. Now we post, you know, come to our Friday volunteer cleanups, and sometimes we get 200 people. I think last Friday we had 175 people show up to the mangroves, which is probably one of the hardest cleanups, because you're, you know, up to your knees in mud, but still, you know, like 175 volunteers getting dirty, collecting plastics. And that's really just obviously through, as Kelly mentioned, but also with the power of social media.
That's incredible. Those before and afters are just like insane. I can't imagine where you'd even start, but then within literally a few hours or a day, you've kind of cleaned up what looks like an impossible task. So you've kind of definitely got an amazing system going on there, and a lot of power behind that picking up. And then when you collect that waste, where does it then go to, and how are you kind of handling it?
We have now 7 facilities around Bali and Java to process the waste, sort it into about 30 different types of plastics or waste. And then it goes through, it's very manual, labor intensive. So we have we now employ 88 local warriors that are, you know, on the river, that are in our sorting hubs to allow us to actually process the waste. And so, you know, that's really where so much of the work, you know, cleaning up is half the battle, But then the second battle is actually, what do you do with the waste? How do you properly separate it? You know, this started off, you know, when we first started in August, last time we were here, you know, we had no facility. Everything was going in the back of our parents' garage, literally very quickly from these Friday community cleanups. You know, we started getting, you know, a couple tons, and then it was all of a sudden, you know, we need to get a proper place to actually process this. Now, you know, thank you to our amazing support system, all of our sponsors were able to, you know, operate these different village models, is what we call them, in order to then process waste. So, you know, we collect around 3,000 kilos a day, so 3 tons, which we're able to process that next day. So allow us, you know, us to keep on running and keep on collecting more plastics.
It's incredible. And you guys are now doing a lot on the data side, right? You're sort of, are you scanning everything that you're getting, all the back of the packages or something, and collecting all of the data from brands and what type of sachets they are? Like, how's that working?
Yeah, so we used to really audit every single piece of waste that was coming in. Now, because we get 3 tons, it's a bit more of a logistic thing, but we take a sample on a monthly basis in each location. So it allows us as well to get a better understanding of potentially different consumption patterns. But what we do as we sort is we not only like kind of have a good understanding of what is the most polluted plastic item that we find, and it's still not bags. So even though there's been a ban on plastic bags in Bali, that's where you see that it's not been properly enforced, and using that data to then like go back to the government and pushing for more enforcement. That's part of the work that we do with that information. And then we go a step further and we look at all of the brands. So that's where we scan. So we've bought a very simple supermarket scanner. We've built a extensive database with over 50,000 individual products. And so when you scan it, it automatically appears, and then we can tell you easily, and we, on a yearly basis, publish a top polluters list in Bali. And as we are expanding throughout Indonesia, we now have the start of a Javanese database. So that's been interesting to see what types of products people consume the most of, but it's typically still your aqua cups, Danone being still the number one most polluting brands, and then like all of your instant coffees, instant noodles, so it's a lot of sachets. So just that allows us to then be able as well to kind of push our campaigning battles one by one, because it's impossible to look at all of the packaging, but really then also talk to the companies and look for longer term solutions, more tangible roadmaps. And so that's been a very exciting part of our work as well, which is just going to take a long time, but we're continuing and pursuing in that.
And when you guys are approaching the governments or the brands that you're finding, what is the general reaction that you're getting from these people? Do they care? Do they have anything that they're trying to implement? Are they giving you support? Like, what's the general reaction?
Luckily, it's been quite positive. It's always, I don't know how many hours we've spent on calls with them. Not all of them have replied from the top 10 list, but I think we've had engaged in good conversations with 4 of them, so that's already a good start. Sometimes we get to talk to their CSR company team, so they're way more involved and aware in terms of sustainability. And some others, it's mainly their marketing and PR team, so that's where it's maybe a bit more greenwashing. But it seems like there is genuine desire of changing things progressively, whether it's the size of the packaging or really switching and focusing on different alternatives from plastic. So there's, of course, no conclusions as of now, but it's more like progressive talks.
Yeah.
So we're positive about things coming along in the long term, especially when it comes to big multinationals. I think they get pressure from other countries as well. So we're really just focused on Indonesia, but I know there's just so many other amazing activists and NGOs that are kind of pushing for a similar change in the industries.
From a governmental perspective, you know, there really isn't been like a national-wide database on plastic. So it's very difficult to understand, you know, what are people consuming? Apart from sales, you know, that these multinationals will know, you know, they know how much, obviously, plastic bottles they sell, they know how much sachets they sell, but that data is not public. And, you know, we've asked for it. We're obviously not getting it back. They're for profit. They don't want to share that information. But, you know, government is really trying to push reduction of plastic pollution to the oceans. You know, Indonesia, you know, there was a study a couple years ago by Jenna Jembach that showed that Indonesia was the second biggest polluter of plastic to the ocean after China. And that really hit home for a lot of the politicians like Luhut, the Minister of Maritime Affairs, Jokowi, the President, to make it their mission. So by 2025, you know, there needed to be a reduction of 70% of plastic into the ocean. So Indonesia has a roadmap that's been, you know, of plastic into the ocean. Key organizations, World Economic Forum, and others. But, you know, we're still not seeing this goal being met. There's this roadmap that's you know, that is supposed to be actively pushed, but we're not yet there. Another key goal is to actually ban all single-use plastics in Indonesia by 2030. Again, 2030, and it's in a long time away. You know, by then, we'll have tripled our plastic production globally. Indonesia being one of the biggest, you know, producers and consumers of plastics. But ultimately to say, one of the more you know, appealing piece of news is that they're working on a roadmap to actually ban and fine producers for their plastics that they're using. So that's where our brand auditing is really coming in handy, in that, you know, they can look at our data. We can have open discussions with all of these brands, with the government, and, you know, actually start asking the questions as into, you know, what is your reduction goal? Are you actually contributing towards collection efforts? You know, are you packaging plastics in non-recyclable packaging? What are we doing I think the discussions and the space is being created to push that forward. But we're still a little bit lacking behind in terms of how do we get there? And so, you know, we haven't yet, we've been too busy in the rivers. Now that we're growing, you know, we finally have an amazing team that we can sort of focus more of our time in Jakarta, in the political alleys. And I think that's what the next couple months are going to be looking like for us, to really push the national agenda and seeing how we can nationally reduce plastic.
Yeah, one thing that I've noticed is that brands, they generally, it's not like they don't care. They just don't really know what to do next, because they'd probably love to swap out plastic, but they don't know what the alternative is, or there's a cost associated, and the bureaucracy that's in these huge corporations. But I do, it's good that there's a conversation happening. And with space available, kind of our mission is to create a circular future. And we do that, like you guys, working with waste, although we're not like physically in the rivers, we're working with organizations like yourself who are supplying us waste plastic, and we're trying to turn it into beautiful objects in order for people to see the value in what they call waste, which obviously there's no such thing as waste. It's a surplus material that's getting chucked away. So how do we get people to realize that this is actually a valuable material that, if handled correctly, they could actually make money from? So you wouldn't throw away something like this glass, for example. You wouldn't just throw it away because it feels of some sort of value. And it's the same with a plastic H2P bottle. It's actually quite valuable, but nobody knows, so they just chuck it away. So we're trying to say, well, can we use design or art or collaboration as the vehicle to make these amazing things that everybody wants? And they're like, oh, well, actually, you can. That's the material to make that thing, so it's valuable. And then we also look at the alternative, which is the kind of more biospace, whether it's mycelium or seaweed or these sorts of things. And I think that isn't yet a viable replacement for plastic. So we feel in the short term, it's how do we change the perception of what the people call waste to knowing it's just a valuable material? And could we build some sort of infrastructure whereby people can take it somewhere and then get paid for it or whatever? I don't know if that's something you guys have thought about.
Something that works really well here in Indonesia is waste banks. People will bring their trash to, you know, the local banjar, the local village station, and in return for their trash, they get money. So that's a system that actually really works here in Indonesia. We've toyed around with the idea of, let's put Dropbox deposit systems in some of the most polluted regions that we're cleaning. But, you know, then we're thinking, okay, we're already collecting 3 tons a day from the rivers, and we only have so much capacity to sort, to wash, to upcycle. So it's definitely something we're always speaking about, and I think we really want to implement is, you know, we do a lot of work along riverbanks, not just cleaning rivers, but cleaning illegal landfills. The main reason why our rivers are polluted in the first place is because people dump, you know, not necessarily into the river, but just in the land. And oftentimes that land happens to be next to the river. As soon as it rains, all that tumbles down into the river and makes its way into the ocean. And if we can, and so we've been doing a lot of cleanups in illegal landfills, completely cleaning them up, sometimes, you know, 20 tons in a week. And once we do that, you know, the last thing we want is for that illegal landfill to be dirty again and to become another illegal landfill. So what if we put Dropbox deposit systems there and, you know, prevent that landfill from happening? But then, you know, this past Friday, we're at a cleanup. One of our team leaders found an illegal landfill next to the beach. He reported it to the local village. We cleaned it up. You know, a week later, that illegal landfill has moved 300 meters somewhere else, just upstream of the river. So, you know, we could put deposit systems there. That might solve that issue. But then what we're struggling with is, you know, how much can we really take in before we become a full, you know, municipal waste management operation? And that's, you know, the scale is incredibly different. Cleaning rivers, we're catching what's flowing downstream, preventing it from going into the ocean. Municipal waste, household waste, you know, that's, you know, 10, 20, 50 times more waste than what we're collecting. And then we need a massive facility, we need massive machines, that's a huge investment. And that's actually sort of a role that we're also playing with government, is sort of acting as a consultant, oftentimes, because they don't, you know who to speak to. They look at us and they say, hey guys, what should we do? Banyuwangi, Bali, a lot of the governmental figures here are asking us sometimes what to do. And I think that's where it becomes a really interesting conversation. You know, how can we stop the plastic issue in Indonesia? And it stems from illegal dumping and sorting at home and proper collection.
I think one of the reasons why we started with rivers is because we're dealing with the dirtiest type of waste out there. You know, it's been sitting in the mud, it's been sitting decomposing in nature, and it's super, super, super dirty. And now, you know, we're able to process that through our recycling hubs. You know, we also have a social enterprise which we're launching in a couple months to actually upcycle into beautiful furniture and design products. But we're taking literally the trash that's been sitting in a river, decomposing, and actually, you know, through now a year and a half of R&D, we're able to turn it into amazing slabs for it to be recycled. And so I think if we can take the dirtiest type of waste out there and do that, then when we're starting to speak about municipal waste or upscale waste, it's a completely different thing. You know, when you see recycled plastic with white in it, oftentimes it's never been in the environment. It's been super clean, probably in household waste. So there's a very big difference. And, you know, our processes currently allow us to recycle 3 tons. So we're really, really excited to see what's possible and, yeah, and continue to push to see, you know, how we can properly show people that this waste out there is completely recyclable.
And it took some time. I think we were, you look at the first sheets, the first slabs we made, you know, they look horrendous. There's dirt pockets everywhere. And it's because we're dealing with the worst type of trash. So, you know, we've been looking at how do we wash plastics, which is a huge bottleneck for us. We invested in a big facility in Denpasar, where it's a full washing line of trash coming from the rivers into our sorting facilities, gets sorted into 30 different materials, and then is brought to this washing station. And, you know, trying to wash it as much as we can in a sustainable way, so that we can create slabs that don't have dirt pockets, that, you know, the clients that buy our furniture don't feel dirty sitting on. It's being fully washed, and we can prove that. But also, I think that's the beautiful story, showing that, you know, this table or this chair is coming from, you know, the river behind this house. You know, it's, I think that's the beautiful story, and that's what we're excited about.
That's incredible, because we found that like certain plastics wash better than others, and we have to be very selective of what we use, because it's the stuff that cleans really easy versus the stuff like you, because you guys are just getting everything. And it's and you're obviously trying to upcycle everything. So it's amazing that you've been able to turn that, like, the grimmest, darkest, like, dirtiest plastic into beautiful objects. So I'm really excited to see that. And I noticed you were at Salomon in France, and they were doing some machinery. Are you working with those guys, or what are those guys up to?
It's really cool. I think that is showing us that, you know, big companies like Salomon are doing amazing work with recycling waste. They're sort of using their offcuts, and, you know, when they make a ski, there's, you know, a slab of plastic, and then they only have the mold that they use, and then everything that's the outer layer is thrown away, and that's with every, you know, every industry. So they're taking that, recycling it into products. But we're just starting to speak to them and seeing what we can do together. They're a company that I think is really cool, and we're looking for collaborations like them to launch products in the future. But you know, so they're sponsoring a barrier, which is exciting. So maybe how can we take that plastic, turn it into something with them? But it's really, I think for us, it's exciting to see a company like Salomon, you know, turn plastics into skis. And it's not just, you know, simple things like furniture. It can be, you know, the most high-tech skis used in the Olympics. It can, as you're saying, plastic can have a very valuable second life that is, it's such a sturdy material that if engineered well, can be very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It is such a good material. If handled correctly, it's like an amazing material, but unfortunately we're not handling it in any sort of circular system, and that's where the problem lies, I guess. This sort of single use throwaway mentality seems to be the major thing that we need to somehow get out of. Because I think if you look at a lot of the kind of studies, or even the reason why plastic was invented in the first place, it was because back in those days there was like ivory trade, lots of natural resources were getting dug up, and it was like very unsustainable. So plastic was invented to combat that, and it became like the sustainable material of the future. It was plastic. In the beginning it was bio-based, and then I think it was in 1926 it then got synthesized into like a chemical form, but it was still seen as a really amazing material to like literally save the environment. And then, you know, by the 1950s it was like consumer culture in America. It was like supermarkets, and yeah, and the other kind of everything was wrapped in plastic, and that was like a luxury to have, like your apple. Like, so like ladies could go with their gloves and like, ooh, don't need to take my gloves off to grab an apple anymore, whatever. And that was the beginning of like this new culture of like everything wrapped in plastic, and then in a plastic bag, and then in a plastic kind of, it just kind of got out of control. And you guys know better than anyone, now we're literally swimming, breathing, and like you can't get away from the stuff. It's in our blood. And I think we spoke about that last time, the credit card size of plastic we're eating every week, which sounds kind of like that can't be possible, but it's actually true. And now it's in our cells. It's causing weird physical alterations to our body. I don't know if you've probably seen what's happening to the human. Like, it's really strange what's going on. Also, like male fertility, it's like really like changing us as human beings, because we're just absorbing plastic 24/7. So it's pretty crazy what's happening with it. But yeah, so tell me a little bit more about your new recycling facility then. These slabs, I've seen the slabs you're making. It looks incredible. From what I first seen, which was like a really kind of like melted slab, and you were just experimenting. And then from the stuff I've seen lately, it looks incredible. So tell us a bit about that journey, and like how you kind of got on board with that, got the machines, and then the R&D, I guess, that's gone into that must have been pretty heavy. Like, yeah, how's that been?
So I think it's as this whole project has kind of been a learning journey, and it's been an organic expansion. We were focused on cleaning, and as Gary said, it's only half of the battle. Then we had to focus on the sorting aspect, because we wanted to upgrade and upcycle as many materials. Essentially, at the beginning, we were just offsetting all of the waste streams to different recycling players in Indonesia. And we would see that there's all of the low plastics don't have a market for them. So that's back to like that circular economy that you were mentioning. So that was typically your plastic bags, and that happens to be the number one item that we collect. Sandals, and like a lot of list of other low-value plastics that are... So all of your PET, your HDPE, there is an existing demand for them, so we're not focusing on it as much. And so we took plastic bags as our first like R&D project. We tested so many different things. I think none of us are engineers, so it was what is existing out there that we can like tap into and test, and precious plastic being an amazing open source resource. And we're like, okay, we'll try that. We happened to work with a company in Bali that happened to make and help us create the kayaks that we built to go down the Chitaram River. So it was like a nice personal historic connection as well. So all of that came together very, very nicely. As you said, when we initially started, in terms of like proportions, how do you heat it? So we have hot presses. But the dirt was always our main issue. When you have a plastic bag, there's so many like dirt pockets inside. So it was like, really, how do you work out that process? So that's been a big R&D project that has been going on for the past year. We're finally getting like a nice clean product, all done in like a nice loop system. So we have like a very nice wastewater treatment facility as well. So it's really just been trying, like, testing on a daily basis. I think it's so much of a passion project. that it's just about spending the necessary time on it and doing all of the little shifts and twists. So we're finally kind of happy with some of the results. We have way and way less defects that we have to like recycle. So we're very like excited to finally be able to turn that into more long-lasting products.
Mm. Yeah, the plastic bags I'm very interested in because that's always been very challenging to recycle. Like we use specifically HDPE. It's a lot easier to handle and recycle and clean everything. And the plastic bags has always been one thing that's been quite challenging. So that was one thing I was very interested in to see what you're going to do with that. And the black and white ones that you did with Futura and Potato Head, that looked really incredible. But yeah, like you mentioned just a bit earlier about the government's like banning plastic bags, but then there's just more of them. Like, how do you think that could, like, is there any, do you think there's any hope in terms of like what these things that the government's implementing actually come into reality, or do you think it's just going to be
That's really where, you know, data comes in. That's really where we need to keep on pushing for regulations, for better ways of implementation. You know, these plastic bags that we've been testing, I think one of the other dirt pockets, yes, but just going back to recycling, I think humidity content, you know, once you wash it, it's super humid, you know, and then you press it in a hot press, so much water comes out. And so we've just been experimenting with that. You know, we've built our own washing machines from scratch. We've had to invent washing machines to clean our plastic. We've had to invent drying machines to clean our plastic. So it's been just super, you know, very R&D. You know, in the early days, we would have a hot press. You know, we'd pick up some plastics from our shelf, put it in, see what happens. Overnight, you know, come back in the morning, and then it's like, oh, this is amazing, beautiful. Okay, we'll come back and do this again. So it's just been like very like scientific approach to see what we can do. But I think that, you know, when we're able to show what's possible, and it goes back to a little bit to what you're saying, you know, with plastic bags, something that you use for 5 seconds, you throw away, something that's very enrooted in Indonesian culture, especially traditional markets. When people start to see bins or a house made from plastic bags, you know, recently one of the things that we've been doing is testing this material in some of our personal projects. So, you know, built a little tiny home from 35,000 plastic bags that I'm living in. And so that's been a really good way as well of testing the sheets, seeing how it, you know, how it reacts with the sun, seeing what binding agents we use before bringing anything commercially. So I think we want to test and test and test before we're able to properly come out with these, you know, with viable products that are going to be long-term, as that I think is one of the key aspects, you know, having something that is heavy, having something that recycles a lot of plastics, that is comfortable. Those are like three of the main principles that we're looking at in every single product that we're making.
Awesome. Yeah, I saw the house you built. Yeah, congratulations. And are you finding, does the plastic warp at all when you're, like, because the elements, especially here in Indonesia, with the heat and the rain and everything, humidity, are you finding that it's warping or is it staying pretty flat?
It's staying pretty flat. It's been out in the sun on a cliff with a lot of rain and a lot of wind over the last 3 months. And I'm actually really happy with the results with plastic bags. No color change yet. I think it's, you know, it's all an R&D. I'm sure you've seen as well with the wall of the Museum of Space Available, and also the Wasted Lab little shack. Color can change. We've seen that as well at Tumabayu with some of the sheets that we've been laying out, more from an HDP perspective. You know, it can crack. Sometimes you have to put a bi-epoxy on it. But, so I think we're really in the space of testing. And I think what's amazing about Bali is that it is a great spot for all these creators that are seeing that there's plastics everywhere and they're genuinely wanting to solve it. So I think having, you know, collaborations like with you guys, with Potato Head, with WeDo, you know, some amazing collaborators on the island, we're able to push the momentum forward and really collaboratively look for real solutions.
Yeah, it's cool because the scene, the Bali scene, as the Financial Times pointed out, because we were all in the piece together, which is really cool, the scene emerging here of like creatives all fighting against the plastic waste crisis, and this kind of global scene is becoming the sort of Bali's become the hub for that, which is really interesting. And for me, the first, like when I first arrived to Bali, I went to Green School, and that was the first time I saw the machines being used. It was a guy called Baxter who then was doing the courses down there. And then from that, we built the Sustainism Lab at Potato Head, I think it was 2016, maybe, or something like that. And then it was kind of like people were just starting to get into it. And then now it's like, it seems to be like everybody is wanting to either get involved in it or they want to purchase them and move from recycled plastic. The awareness is just huge. And it's cool that Bali's become the place for that. Have you guys seen the interest grow generally in terms of when you started to now? Of people wanting to either get involved or like getting into the fact of like working with recycled plastic or even buying goods from recycled plastic? Have you seen interest grow?
Sorry, I think we're seeing that even from WeDo, the company who made our press machines. I think we were the second or third press machine that he made. And recently when we, because now he's sort of our machine, he's one of our machines guy that we always go to for advice. He makes a lot of our balers to bale all of our trash. So we can, for example, the PET water bottles. So we always order new machines from him. And he's like, yeah, my request for new machines has skyrocketed in the past. Because I think it's like Gary was saying, people are making sheets. And sure, you know, you can take a great photo of a sheet. But if you actually try it yourself, it's not as easy as it seems. And it takes, you know, a lot of plastic because you need a lot of plastic for one sheet. And so much trial and error. If you don't have a shredder, you know, what happens to that sheet? You need to reshred it to repress it. But so just from him, he's told us he's building 12 new sheet press machines or something crazy like that. He's improving his sheet press machines, which is great. I think inevitably we want to inspire people to see this material as value. And you know, why not have Bali become this place for change and for being the recycling hub?
Exactly like your hat says.
Exactly. Value recycling club.
Yeah, we should all like make it, shouldn't we? We should all join the club and make it. Because we made this for fun. Obviously, we are starting like a workshop series where we're teaching people how to do it and things. And we are working with WeDo as well on that. But we should all, yeah, we should maybe all put our individual name, company names on and kind of like our badges or something, you know?
Yeah.
And have the proper club going, have club meetups and stuff, you know?
But I think what's also cool is although it's happening here in Bali, when we speak to other people on the islands, they see recycled plastic and they're like, oh yeah, you know, Potato Head's doing it, Space Available's doing it, Ecolaborate's doing it. But when you speak to someone in New York or you speak to someone in London or in Paris, they still think of recycled plastic as this super dark or thing that they've never seen.
And industrial process.
Yeah, industrial process. And then when they come over to our space, they're like, wait, this is the machine you're using to make this chair? Like, yeah, it's not that complicated. I think starting with Bali, but bringing this message around the world, I think Precious Plastic have been doing an amazing job, but it is still funny, you know, speaking to some of our friends around the world and seeing what they think about the process. They think we have, you know, this huge warehouse, but really it's still quite rudimental.
Yeah, it's surprising not a lot of people know about it, even in the UK. I mean, UK's starting to change a little bit now, but it's whenever we go up there with our products, no one's even seen it before. They're like, wow, this is like, how do you do this? And because we've been doing this for so long, you forget that in major cities, no one's even thinking about this. But because we are on an island, maybe we're a bit more connected. And obviously, thanks to people like you guys who are really kind of like physically showing people like how bad this is and you're doing work and, you know, some pretty grimy work that you guys are doing, because we've done it a few times now and it's like it's really, yeah, it's not pleasant work, you know, like we're all designing using trash, but when you're physically in a river not knowing what's underneath you and pulling out, so credit to you guys for actually, you know, doing that, because not a lot of people would some people might do it, but to actually create something of the scale that you guys have created, it's not an easy thing. So thank you for doing that, and congratulations on all the great work you've been doing, and keep on. And I'm really excited to see the furniture and love to collaborate with you guys in whatever way we can and spread the message further. So yeah, cool. Thank you so much for coming down, guys, and maybe we'll speak again in another couple of years and there'll be a bigger impact. So, but yeah, really appreciate it, and looking forward to seeing you guys again soon.
Awesome.
Thanks so much. Cheers.
Cheers.